The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello. It's really great to be back in Philadelphia. It's been 5 years. It seems as if I had just been here a week or two ago, and that everybody I met had stayed at the library, and they're just waiting for me to come back with all the same faces. It's a great occasion, too, of course, because it is the 20th birthday for the things they carried, which in a way, of course, is delightful. And in another way, as I now tour around the country in a little mini tour on behalf of the book, is a little sad, too. Because I find myself talking in Los Angeles and San Francisco and New York and now in Philadelphia about many of the things I had been talking about 20 years ago in the context of, as you know, two new wars. That puts a certain damper on what could otherwise be an occasion of total celebration. As I tried to consider what I'd do tonight, it struck me that what I really want to do and will spend the bulk of my time doing is responding to comments and questions, and I tried to save plenty of time for that. Another thought that occurred to me as I began preparing for tonight was that it's hard for an author to in any meaningful way address his own book. Because you end up paraphrasing, and you end up summarizing. When you've spent all those years in your underwear in front of a computer doing the reverse, writing sentences and trying to be detailed and avoiding paraphrase and summary, trying to make stories come alive, that there's a tendency when you're talking about your own work to sort of pull a thread out and talk about that story or that character or that theme. And as you pull the thread out, the cloth itself feels as if it's unraveling right before your eyes as you're doing that. And your thoughts as a writer and a speaker are on everything you're not saying. And it's hard to concentrate on what you are saying. So what I thought I'd do is at least begin tonight from a completely different angle of vision on it. What I want to do is to read to you a letter that I received almost exactly 2 years ago, that had come from a young woman of 26 years old who lives in my home state of Minnesota. And after reading this letter, I want to talk about why I wanted to read the letter to you. Dear Mr. O'Brien, I thought about writing this letter for the past 10 years. In grade school, when I needed to go to the basement closet to get a game or a sleeping bag, I used to stare at the two uniforms hanging still and gathering dust with the nameplate Wyden on the front of the uniforms. And I just stand there wondering. When I went to high school, I came across a carved dark wood box under my father's bed. Inside the box were shiny pins, a tasseled triangular ornament, and a black and white photo of a younger, smoking version of my father with another man in a place that was obviously not Minnesota. But my father never talked about Vietnam, or he'd brush it off by saying, yes, yes, he'd been there, but that he hadn't done anything special, nothing worth talking about. One thing the three of us kids knew growing up was that our parents loved us and would do and did anything for us. Something else we knew but didn't talk about was how bad things were between them. They had known each other for 6 months and had $200 in the bank when they got married, both of them thinking it was a smart thing to do, to get on with their lives, to get on the right track. By high school, things were at their worst. I had become more a friend and a counselor than a daughter. My mother telling me everything that had gone wrong in her life, needing someone to understand the guilt she felt for not being able to fall in love with my father. My dad, ever noble, kept trying to keep their financial and personal problems away from us kids. I had grown very close to both of them, but my father always listened. He never opened up. He never talked. I was first introduced to your writing in high school. I read The Things They Carried from my AP U.S. history class. I passed the book on to my dad and asked him what he thought. I asked about the uniforms still in that basement and the box still under that bed. And finally, after all those years, he began to talk. Over the next few years, we passed your books back and forth, and I learned more and more about my dad. I learned about his bluegrass band back in high school, the Flint Hill Singers, that got offered a record deal that all their parents turned down so they go to college. I learned that he was a theater major at the University of Duluth, but halfway through went to Vietnam, then to Germany, then finished college back in Duluth, started at Luther Seminary, married my mother, quit seminary, had no money, and so started working as a technical writer for computer companies, a job he hated. While I was in college, my dad would find some excuse to come down to Northfield, St. Olaf College, and we'd end up talking over a beer at the Rubenstein pub. By that point, I was hearing stories I had never imagined about my dad, like one summer after his sister put him to bed during a party when their parents were gone, he snuck out his bedroom window in Minneapolis, drunk and laughing the whole time, waking up the next morning 200 miles away in a field south of Duluth with a cow licking his window. I learned how he had volunteered for a position in Vietnam before he got drafted so he wouldn't have to kill anyone. I learned how part of his job was to help soldiers get over their drug addictions before they went home. I learned that the tasseled ornament in that box under his bed was really a part off a stripper's costume in Vietnam. I learned that that's where my father had lost part of his hearing. I learned that he had felt lost and didn't know what to do with himself when he got home, a displaced, folk-singing, peaceful actor at heart. But the best part about all this talking was that we finally were talking about my father and about my mother, being open and honest and not denying the situation anymore. They finally went back to counseling, forgave one another, and forgave themselves. They stayed together and have a life outside their three grown kids. They aren't perfect, but they're happy. I'm 26, married, teaching elementary music, and have a life of my own. But my dad and I still share books, something I think we'll always do. I realize this letter is long, more than you needed to hear, and maybe lacking in a clear point. I guess that all these years, I've just wanted to say thank you. Reading and sharing your books became a starting place to know and to understand my father, and through my father, my mother. Your books helped start a conversation that turned into something so much more important. For that, I will always be grateful. Sincerely, and I won't mention the name. Well, why do I offer this letter to you tonight? Well, first, just because I think it's beautifully written. That is to say, sometimes good writing doesn't have a clear point, or if it has a point, it has 100 points that gleam at you like a wall of jewels, and to pluck one out and say that's the point, that's usually a pretty bad story. Those are those stories my kids will sort of look at me as if, you're not telling a story, you're doing an English class here. As the letter demonstrates, perhaps like any novel, certainly any decent novel, books have to be aimed, finally, not just at the head, but also at the human heart and the stomach and the tear ducts and the nape of your neck. Stories are intended, unlike nonfiction, for the whole human being, and not just for the rational side of the human being. They're aimed at that inside the human heart that can quake in terror or laugh in joy. For all the complications and the ambiguities of the things they carried, it is finally intended to make you feel something of what it was to be a foot soldier in a long-gone war in Vietnam, and something of what it may be to be a foot soldier in a not-so-long-gone war in, say, a place called Afghanistan or a place called Iraq. Unlike history or journalism, so full of statistics and facts and dates, the things they carried is meant to transport you to a time and to a place, to put you inside the heads of individual human beings as they crouch in ambush, or as they carry their wounded buddies out to a medevac chopper, or as they trudge through the paddies and up into the mountains and down into the swamps. Stories are meant to help us participate in events such as a war, or a marriage, or a childhood, and not just learn about those events in an abstract way. It is one thing to sit in front of a CNN report on an event in Afghanistan. It's another thing to be in Afghanistan through a novel or a story, or to feel as if one were in the boots of those people. Secondly, this letter reminds me, at least, and I hope you, that stories actually matter, believe it or not, in the lives of real people out there in a real world. They are not just for English classes. They have an effect on human beings. And if that letter doesn't demonstrate that, I don't know what else it does demonstrate. Too often as a writer, it seems to me that my books seem to go off into this kind of black hole out there in the universe where they're sort of sucked into it, and you don't see the faces or see the hearts ticking of those people who are reading the books. And only when I receive letters or emails such as this one from a woman I'll call Nancy do I realize that occasionally one of my stories has an impact way beyond anything I intended. I did not write The Things They Carried to have Nancy and her father reach a point of reconciliation and talk. I didn't know Nancy, and I didn't know her father or her mother. And yet, books can do things in hearts and in minds way beyond anything an author may have intended as the author sat down to write that book. Thirdly, I offer the letter to you as a reminder that wars do not end when you sign a peace treaty. They go on and on in the lives of families, such as that of Nancy, long after hostilities have ceased. Wars continue in the nightmares and the visions, the walking fantasies of veterans, and in the unending grief of a mom who lost her son 40 years ago in a jungle in Vietnam. Some poor elderly woman now down, let's say, in Orlando, Florida, wakes up each morning and, where's my little baby? That war is not over, and it won't be over for that gal. nor is it over for my mom, my sister, and brother. Wars keep echoing in the lives of the widows and the brothers and the sisters, the sons and daughters. It's an easy thing to forget, although we all know it intellectually. But it's easy to forget that sitting here in this auditorium, in this great library, that out in the world, there are people in Afghanistan and Iraq and here in America are in a state of grief right now that'll never end. Fourth, the letter reminds me of the power of stories to help us heal. If the things they carried helped Nancy and her father and her mother come to some kind of reconciliation with their past, that book was well worth those 5 hours of hard work, grinding away, making sentences, hoping for the miracle that these stories may come alive in this world. I had the illusion as I became a writer back in somewhere in my mid-20s, that the work of writing would somehow get easier with practice, say the way it might get easier for a mortician. You know, if you do it often enough, you're not going to be as afraid of it, and it's not going to gross you out, and you'll get good at it, making people who are dead look alive. And it's not that easy with writing. I found out the hard, long way. You can see by the creases in my eyes that it took its toll. You can't repeat yourself. You can't write the same sentence. You can't tell the same story, even though every bone in your body is calling out to do just that. Write a sentence like that one, which that reviewer liked, but one can't, because you're simply repeating yourself, and there's no fun in doing that. So I found that in the composition of not just that book, but of all my work, that the difficulties don't efface themselves over time or evaporate over time. In fact, they compound themselves. Each book gets harder and harder and harder to write. Partly because you learn so much about what can go wrong in the writing of books. But having said that, when I receive a letter such as this one, or many, many like it coming to me here in a time of war, from the daughters and the sons and the wives and the girlfriends of veterans, it makes all that labor, which at the time really was laborious, it was tough work, it makes it all worthwhile. Way beyond the awards and the money and everything else that can attend success as a writer, a letter such as this one makes me think back to when I was 24 or 23 and beginning this trade, of why I began it, which was to touch people and to reach somehow into the human heart and give it a little squeeze. There are wives and sons and daughters out there who are carrying burdens much like those I carried. And still carry through my life. More than 40 years ago, in May of 1969, I found myself lying in a muddy irrigation ditch outside a little village in Quang Nai Province. There was fierce gunfire all around me. People were dying. People were squealing. And it was there, in that slimy, algaed irrigation ditch, that the things they carried was in some sense conceived down inside me. I knew that the stink of that irrigation ditch would be something I would carry in my lungs to the grave. I would carry the sound of that gunfire, too, and the fear, and the sense of abandonment by God and, in a way, by my country, which seemed so far away, almost on another planet. I knew I would carry a certain bitterness, anger at those who made the war, anger at their ignorance and platitudes and fake, simplistic patriotism and hypocrisy, and outright lying, and self-righteousness, and fake piety, all that underlay that war. Anger at my hometown draft board, a place that couldn't find Hanoi on a map. You know those blank maps they hand out in first grade, and you say you write in the name of the country? They couldn't spell the word, even if you spotted them all the vowels and all the consonants. They couldn't put them in the right order. They just knew it was a war to kill communists, the end, go to it. And who took a kind of willful pride in their ignorance at the Kiwanis meeting or the Lions Club. I'm proud I don't know anything. This is a war to kill communists, and I don't want to know anymore. Why complicate it? I think you can feel and hear in my voice a little tremble of the bitterness that was born inside me in that the slime of that irrigation ditch as my friends died all around me. All this, the fear, that sense of abandonment, the bitterness, and even a touch of cynicism, was represented for me and will remain represented for me by the godforsaken stink of that irrigation ditch. I want to switch gears for just a moment and to kind of move away from the war and move into my life now and then kind of return to the war before taking your questions. As Marie mentioned in her introduction, I have two little kids. I'm a late-blooming father. I've got a four-year-old whose name is Tad, and I've got a six-year-old whose name is Timmy. And about, I don't know, this is hard, but all this stuff blurs together. You know, fatherhood's like war. It's all chaos and bewilderment. But it feels like 6 months ago, but it may have been, you know, 3 years ago, or it might have been yesterday, somewhere in there. The little one, the four-year-old Tad, I caught him in the bathroom peeing into a wastebasket. And this was not just a wastebasket. This was one of these steel mesh wire, you know, that. And so, and on top of that, we had recently installed a new, we'd done this remodel thing. We'd installed this pretty beautiful plush maroon rug that doesn't look good against yellow. And, I was pretty upset. I rarely lose it with these kids. I've got a bad temper, but I've really managed to keep it under control. But I lost it in a way. I didn't hit him or anything, but my voice, you might say, got a bit stern and loud. And I said, "Why are you doing that? Why? You know better. Why? And at a much louder volume than that and a much more strident pitch. But the kid was paralyzed. He's 4 years old. And I'm not even sure he knows what the word "why" really means and all its complications. And he stood, you know, paralyzed. Well, I didn't let it go there. I should have, but I didn't. I made him get down on his hands and knees and, you know, try to blot it up with toilet paper. And the problem with that is toilet paper, is, as you know, is made to disintegrate, and things got worse and they didn't get better. We had not had just the problem with the pee, we had the problem with the toilet paper, and it was a big problem. My wife came in finally. Her name's Meredith, and she sent me away, and I went back to my study. I'm not sure if she was more upset with me or with the kid, with both of us. Anyway, about 45 minutes or an hour later, Tad came into my study, and he said, "Daddy, Daddy." I said, "What?" And he said, "I've got two heads." And I said, "What?" And he said, "I've got two heads." I said, "What?" He said, "Two heads. You asked why I did it. One head said, 'This is going to be fun.'" And the other head said, "Daddy's not going to like this." Well, that night I had this ritual. I'm a writer, so I tell the kids stories at night, pretty elaborate stories. And I felt terrible about losing my cool in that bathroom. And I said, "You know, Tad, this is bedtime now, and the two kids are flanking me, you know. I said, I feel terrible about this. And, you know, I knew somebody with two heads once upon a time myself." And Tad said, "Who was that?" And I said, "His name was Daddy." And he looked at my neck as if, like, where was this thing cut off? Like, crazy, literal-minded. And I said, "No, I don't mean it quite that way. I mean it the way you meant it. I had two heads." And he said, "Well, where was this?" And I told him it was back in my college years at McAllister, and this war was raging all around, and I was afraid I might have to go to it. And Timmy, the older kid, said, "What's that?" And I said, "What's what?" And he said, "Well, war." And I said, "Well, you know, Star Wars." And these kids are big on, you know, Star Wars and stuff like that. And I said, "Well, it's like Star Wars." And he said, "Well, why were you afraid?" And I said, "Well, because people actually died in these wars. It wasn't make-believe." And Tad, the four-year-old, said, he was astonished. He said, "You're kidding. I mean, really, die? People kill each other? Really?" And for both these kids at 4 and 6 had been a form of entertainment, kind of, with the knowledge that people wake up and from the dead and walk the earth, and it's not forever. The notion of foreverness struck both these kids that evening with a kind of ferocity that made me again feel something like a bad father. And yet at the same time, at least a realistic father. Well, I talked for a while in that bed that night about these two heads I had carried with me through college and then through graduation as the war approached. One head saying more or less, "I love my country and I want to do I want to be looked on as a patriot and a good American. I want to be loved in my hometown. I want my mom and dad to admire me and love me." The other head was saying, "This is wrong." And it was almost talking to the first head, saying, "You've got a conscience. And your conscience is saying you shouldn't be killing people if you don't think it's the right thing to do. And you shouldn't be dying either if you don't think there's justice and rectitude in it." Well, as I lay in bed, Tad is now long asleep and Timmy is asleep as well. And I'm essentially lying there more or less talking to myself, no longer aloud, but inside myself, about what was the real war in Vietnam for the guy you're looking at now. The real war had little to do with bombs and bullets and the grainy footage you see on television about that war from that era. It had little to do with the tunnels and the mountains, and the paddies. It had to do more so with that moral squeeze on a 21-year-old kid named Tim O'Brien with these two yapping heads. One of them wanting to be John Wayne for his country, and the other wanting to be Abby Hoffman for his country. I felt as if that summer of 1968, the summer I was drafted, I felt as if I had been split open down my belly and the ribs pried open with two hearts beating and these two heads going, trying to make my mind up about what do you do if you think something is wrong and your country wants you to do it anyway. What do you do when you're forced to do something and not just yak about it in bars and in college, when you really have to do something, either go or don't, and there's no in between. You don't sort of go or you don't sort of don't go. It's one or the other. And you're 21 years old, and you're entangled in global politics, and it's squeezing the life out of you. Well, what do you do? Well, I wanted to conclude what do I say when I'm talking about the things they carried? I'm essentially talking about one chapter, I suppose, the chapter called On the Rainy River, which tells the story of this guy with two heads as he journeys up to the Canadian border, trying to decide, should I go to Canada or should I go to the war? But I wanted to do it in a more personal way. That's a piece of fiction. The two-head story is no fiction because you're looking at a guy who still, in a lot of ways, bears two heads about that time. I want to stop now. I have more notes here, but my instincts are telling me I'd rather. This is the Philadelphia Library, and I know there are smart people here, and I'd rather conclude here and engage in conversation with you. This is not some junior high audience where I got to fill up the time. So I'm going to stop, and I want to spend the rest of my time taking your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. We've got about 20 minutes for questions, and we know it's a smart audience, and I know you probably have a lot of them. But if you could keep them brief so that we could get to as many of you as possible. Raise your hand. I'll get you a mic. And why don't we start? Who would like to start us off? Lady in the front here in red.
Tim, we don't have a draft now. What do you think the role of fiction is maybe in a situation like we're in today, where we are pretty cut off from what those soldiers are doing?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, there are a lot of similarities between the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. There's one huge difference, which, of course, is the absence of a draft. The wolf is not at the door in Dubuque and Sioux City and across this country the way it was when middle-class households were getting those yellow notices showing up in the mailboxes. It's a volunteer army. Beyond that, those who are volunteering are of a certain temperament and of a certain political point of view and of a certain carry a certain adventurism into that war that doesn't reflect much of what I experienced among my compatriots in Vietnam. I had the occasion to go to Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, where we sent Parade magazine sent me there to do a cover story about our wounded veterans. And so I journeyed down south. It's about a 45-minute drive from where I live. And for the first time, I had really encountered those who had given up their arms and their legs and their heads and their ears and their noses. These are the worst of the worst casualties of this place here in Walter Reed. And I felt a eerie sense that I was back in Vietnam in a way, because our casualties sort of mimic these. Lots of landmines blowing off arms and legs. Lots of burn victims. They looked in a way very similar, the youth in those faces. The difference, though, was when I began talking to these guys, they were and one woman who had lost a leg in Iraq. Her Jeep had been hit by a rocket. There was an earnestness that was there, and an absence of irony, and a kind of uniformity of support for the cause. That uniformity, that kind of homogenized, it's everybody's for it. That did not echo what was happening in my company in Vietnam. It wasn't as if there was mutiny in our companies, but there was a sense of irony and edge about it all, and certainly questions were being asked. Well, that's a big difference. And I don't mean to, knock one and support the other. I just mean it's a difference, and it's a big one. Literature, as it flows out of an experience, is going to bear the stamp of that kind of tone. It's going to bear the stamp of it. And so far, it more or less has. There have been some terrific first-person narratives to come out of Nathaniel Fick's book, and a book by, I can't remember her last name. Her first name's Kayla. Do you remember that book, Andy? It's really a remarkable book about a woman's, trying to be a soldier in such a sexist environment that it still is, and how she's fighting two wars, sort of one war against the enemy and one war against the guys all around her. It's two battles on two fronts, both really terrific testaments, but neither of which would ever be mistaken for a book that would have come out of Vietnam. And I think that dynamic is generally true of all wars. I doubt that, say, Naked and the Dead would have been written by a veteran of Vietnam. I doubt that the Red Badge of Courage would have been written, well, Crane wasn't a veteran, but I doubt that book would have been born out of Vietnam as well, because of the rhetoric that underlies the way the story is told. So there's no point, I guess, to this answer any more than there was to Nancy's letter, except to say that the literature that's going to come out of these wars is going to be a function in large part of the people who go to the wars, the kinds of people they are and what they bring to them, and not just home with them.
Another question right here in front.
Okay. Thank you for this book, Tim. In the front of the book, you say that all except a couple of events are fiction, and then you insert the writer who resembles you has written books by the same titles. I'm interested in how I'm intrigued by that whole mix of what's the truth and fiction, and when you had that idea in the process of writing this book to insert the writer. And any thoughts about how you juggled both sides of the line of that?
Okay. Well, the book does blur a line between what actually happened in a literal sense and what happens in an imaginative sense or a dream sense. And it's not a cutesy or an intellectual issue for me. It's pretty visceral. I ended up in Vietnam as if I had come to Wonderland, where the old truths were no longer true. I was raised a good stout Methodist, and we were taught thou shalt not kill, and you get to Vietnam, and you'd better kill, or we're going to court-martial your ass. It's not just you can, you'd better do it. If you were doing what I was doing as a rifleman. And that makes you begin to question all kinds of stuff, mainly stuff about what's true about yourself. Am I capable of it? The guy who doesn't believe in this war, am I going to go out and shoot people anyway? And by people, we always think it's, in wars, it's you against the enemy soldier, but it's not that way. It's total chaos. These fights are not happening in some, sterile environment where the enemy's in one room and you're in another and nobody else is around. They're happening in the situations of villagers around and kids and teenagers and old men. And your bullets don't always hit, what you think you're aiming at. Bombs don't always fall exactly where they think they're going to fall. It's chaotic. And one begins asking questions of yourself. I mean, as I did, and I know some of my fellows, not some, of a good many of my fellow soldiers asked a similar questions. Up becomes down, and what was down is now up. There's a tangled, messy feel to it that seems to undermine the notion of the definite and therefore of truth itself. Nothing seems very definite in a war. And the word truth somehow implies at least a sense of that's definite. And you lose your sense of the everything seems evolving and changing, including yourself. So what may seem on the surface in the things they carry to be an intellectual problem or a discussion or a paradox is really, for me at least, born out of an experience I had gone through. I also think that if you had gone through a bad marriage that ended in horror and betrayal, you'd feel a bit of what's true and what's not true. I thought I was loved, and was I ever? And you'd find yourself questioning the word love. What is love if it doesn't last forever? Is it love, or is it some lower form of love? And if a lower form of love is also love, what about the upper form? What does it do to that? That's an example of what I mean when I say the things they carried, finally, for me, is not a book just about war. It's about all of our lives, our childhoods and our loves and our children. In the end, it's about the things we all carry, I think.
Another question. Gentleman all the way in back there standing up, if you could wave for the mic.
Hey, how you doing? My question might be one that you get all the time, but I was wondering if you could tell me what advice you would give to a young writer.
Well, I have two pieces of advice, and I don't think anyone will want to hear either one of them. They're too scary. But I'm going to say them because they're so hard. It's hard one, but number one, you need to be a donkey or a mule, willing and able to keep plodding up a very high and difficult mountain. Inspiration is a part of what I do for a living and for fun, but a small part. That the drudgery of sitting down every morning and to face that next scene or the next paragraph requires the making of sentences. And you may have a great story in your mind, and you may even have it fairly detailed in your mind as to what is going to occur down the line. But nonetheless, you have to face that sentence, and you have to write it. And you have to write it reasonably gracefully. And you have to write it in such a way that you feel as a writer you haven't read it before, that you haven't copped it off as the world turns or out of Ulysses. It's your sentence, and it carries the sound of your voice. And also maybe doing two different things is a good sentence. Well, it'll not just do one thing, it'll do a couple of things. To face sentence after sentence after sentence is finally how every novel ever written has been made. It hasn't been done with a touch here and a touch there. It's been done with the accumulation of sentences. Not always are they always arranged in exactly the order you'll with which you'll confront them in a book, but they've been written. And you need a kind of tenacity or a stubbornness of spirit or temperament to carry you through that. Joseph Conrad had this terrific piece of advice. I mean, I should remember, and back when I was young, I used to remember this sort of stuff. I don't anymore. But he said, the line that I recall is, the sitting down is all. And I'm with Conrad. So even if he didn't mean it this way, I take it this way, is to sit down every day and to confront the horrible unknown of those writing those sentences. That's even if you know where the story is going. The second piece of advice is that this is really hard to tell to students, but I do it anyway. You got to learn grammar. You can't walk around the world thank you. Most places, I mean, I say this in high schools, I mean, I get dead silence. I mean, it's as if I uttered, like, join the devil church or something. I mean, really, it feels that way. And it's not that I'm the grammar police, and it's not as if Huckleberry Finn, doesn't make my, I know that. But you have to have a command of the language in order to richly write about the world we live in. The thought strikes me that, and it's, writers have these 26 letters in the alphabet and a few punctuation marks, and that's it. And out of those 26 letters, you can make a copy of Hustler or Stag magazine, or you can make the Bible or Ulysses. The same 26 letters. The same way with, for those like biochemists among us here, there's these four bases that make up the DNA. There's anion, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. And out of that, you're made, and I'm made. Hitler was made. Eva Braun was made. Bill Clinton was made. Everybody out of these four bases, all of us. And a writer feels something of the same. And to have a command of the bases and how they interrelate and how letters work and how it has to do with the music that ultimately is going to underlie every story that's written. That we could, it's one thing to, in public, talk about the themes of books and their meaning and the characters in the books. But all of that ultimately is going to ride on a music of language, on the pace of it. And even if as a reader you don't know it, you are being buoyed along in books you love by the sound of the prose beneath it. What you will notice are potholes along the way. Those you will wake up from and you'll say, God, that was a mistake. And when I read somebody writing lie instead of lay, I wake up. And I sort of think, oh, my God, if the writer doesn't know this, maybe this person doesn't know what love is either. And what a ghost is. Everything gets a little suspect, as it would to a mathematician, I think, who encountered somebody who couldn't add and, was giving some scientific paper, for Nature magazine. You'd get suspect. So to learn the language is it's also fun because you enrich yourself as you're learning it.
Let's see. About eight rows back, lady with her hand up, black sweater. Yeah.
Hi. Hi. The things that carried, the piece that opens the things that carried, is really beautiful. And can you talk a little bit about the process of writing that, what you went through? Like, it's incredibly smooth, and it seems like a lot of work, unless it was just perfect from the get-go.
I couldn't hear that. Can you? So the first chapter, you mean? Oh. Well, the first chapter it was written later. I mean, I can't remember exactly when. I know it was not the first thing I wrote in the book, but it was meant to be a kind of, it begun and it was ended, and it was written to be a kind of overture to the book. It's written in a different person than the rest of the book. Yeah, and it's meant to sound as like it's meant to touch all the themes that I wanted to reach out to touch in the book. It was also a great example of what I was just talking about, that it was a story born almost solely in language, the sound of the prose. I wanted to ape the feel of, in my prose, of what it is to trudge along, to hump, as we called it in Nam, one step and then the next, and to keep humping, and how the hump was everything, you know, over the mountains and down into the paddies, and to feel that, make a story, really prolonged story, to carry the cadences of the march. I also wanted to write a story in which I would use in every way I can possibly imagine the word carry, the ways that the word carry could be used, and to make it, and to integrate it into the story. You could, some men would carry themselves with poise. That's one use of the word, or carry on, the soldier's expression, which goes beyond soldiering. It goes into life itself. For all the horror and brutality we're all going to face in our lives, somehow, as Faulkner said, we carry on. And then, of course, to carry the burdens of our lives that begin with the physical and move into the emotional and the spiritual and the psychological and so on, has its own feel. And I mined the thesaurus, and I mined the dictionary, you know, Webster's Third, for fairly obscure uses of the word carry. Not obscure in the sense that we don't use them, but they don't occur to you if someone were to ask you, what does the word carry mean? They wouldn't pop into your mind right away. But the usages of the word are myriad, and I tried to incorporate them in the book. Why? Because I wanted to get a feel. Remember I said earlier in this talk that for me, writing is different, fiction is different, for me at least, from nonfiction in one essential thing. My object is not to instruct you, it's not to preach to you or to myself. My object is really to make your body feel something. And by repetition and by the cadence stuff of that book, of that story, I wanted to have you sort of feel what it was to do that, to slog through this horrid war with me, with the burdens accumulating with every step, the burdens of guilt and responsibility, the burdens of memory, the burdens of all the ghosts of all those dead people, Vietnamese and your buddies both. Now the burdens keep getting heavier and heavier and heavier with every step you take, which I think has a pretty good analog in life itself as we get older.
I see a lot of hands. Unfortunately, we only have time for one more on our left. The gentleman about 10 back.
That's not who he had in mind, but thanks. I guess I want to follow up on what you were just talking about. The story is not a linear story. To what extent is the arrangement of the stories a matter of feel, and to what extent is it a matter of strategy or planning on your part? And was the lives of the dead always going to be the final story?
The answer to the last question is yes. The lives of the dead was always, I wanted to reach very bluntly and directly outside the war into the lives of us all, the death of a little girl, this girl in fourth grade dying of brain cancer. And so that the themes of the book would not be so solely centered on war. I worried about that through the whole composition of the book. I had intended to write, and I think I ended up writing a book that's on the surface partly about war, yeah, but pretty clearly about being father stuff and childhood stuff and being a writer stuff. I wanted to go beyond it while using the war as the central image or central context, rather, for the book. I intentionally placed How to Tell a True War Story, I think one of the better stories in the book, almost the dead center of the book. Because it has to do with the main theme that we were talking about earlier of how do you know what's true is true, and how true is that we so take for granted as a country and individually can be pulled out from under us, and how that absence of certainty that goes out from under you does ragged things to the human soul, does dangerous things to the soul as well. It makes murder possible, and it makes brutality possible. If nothing matters, and if thou shalt not kill and you better kill, why not just do it? Why not just waste everything? And you get shot at enough, and you lose enough friends, and you get angry enough, and you get frustrated enough, It's easy to start blowing away a little baby water buffalo. It's not only easy, it's fun. It's good. You're going to eat hamburgers anyway. Let's do it. And let's not just blow it away. Let's hurt it. Let's not just kill it. Let's hurt it first by shooting it in the flanks and the nose. This is part of the How to Tell a True War story. And it has to do with what the word war is such an abstract and common word, and we're so inured to it that I wanted to find some way to break through the word war, that it's such a party pooper of a word and so common off our tongues that it has become in a way almost meaningless. It's horror and savagery and the grief underneath it all and the nastiness underneath it all. And I wanted that truth thing at the center of the story, the center of the book, and I put it there. I began the book, it was a sort of structural thing, with the overture thing we just talked about, which plainly begins in there. Also, as a writer, one's attention is on pace. And after a fairly long chapter, I wanted at least one or two chapters you could read in 4 minutes or 3 minutes. Because partly the war came at you that way. It came at you in little spurts of memory. There's no beginning, and there's no after. The dentist showed up one day, and you do it. And in large part, that's meant to be a reflection of how I now, all these years later, look back on Vietnam. I don't look back on it with a sweep of memory and of chronology. That's all been erased for me. All I really have left is a kind of collage of little videotapes, and some might last a minute and some 5 minutes or some two, and sometimes just little snapshots as well of a face here and of a sight, a vision there. And I wanted the book to kind of reflect that, how in some things in the world we can remember it at some length and with some clarity and precision. And other memories are stark, but they're short. And so I tried to arrange the book, to pace the book in that way, to get at that, ultimately a feel. That was my only real objective in this book, was I wanted you to feel something of what I felt. I would put myself in the place of Rat Kiley, the narrator of a couple of these stories, who says explicitly what I was feeling. I want you to feel something. I'm going to exaggerate, and I'm going to make things up. I'm going to invent. I'm going to do whatever I can to make you feel what I felt that day. And he was pretty much my stand-in in his rhetoric about that for the way I wanted to approach the book. Well, as I predicted, the questions were incredible. I wish we could go on for like 5 hours, but we're going to call it an end. Thank you all for coming, and thank you. Good night. Whoa. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.